Yes.
You think you'll find a way to him, don't you? He asked, his voice bemused. You think that somehow, if he's alive, you'll find a way.
He shook his head and gave a short laugh.
I've given you power beyond all dreaming, and you can't wait to run off and keep house for your tracker.
I knew I should stay silent, play the diplomat, but I couldn't help myself.
You haven't given me anything. You've made me a slave.
That's never what I intended, Alina.
He ran a hand over his jaw, his expression fatigued, frustrated, human. But how much of it was real and how much was pretense?
I couldn't take chances, he said. Not with the power of the stag. Not with Ravka's future hanging in the balance.
Don't pretend this is about Ravka's welfare. You lied to me. You've been lying to me since the moment I met you.
His long fingers tightened around the glass.
Did you deserve my trust?
He asked, and for once his voice was less than steady and cold.
Bagra whispers a few accusations in your ear and off you go. Did you ever stop to think of what it would mean for me, for all of Ravka, if you just disappeared?
You didn't give me much choice.
Of course you had a choice. And you chose to turn your back on your country, on everything that you are.
That isn't fair.
Fairness, he laughed. Still, she talks of fairness. What does fairness have to do with any of this? The people curse my name and pray for you, but you're the one who was ready to abandon them. I'm the one who will give them power over their enemies. I'm the one who will free them from the tyranny of the king.
And give them your tyranny in return.
Someone has to lead, Alina. Someone has to end this. Believe me, I wish there were another way.
He sounded so sincere, so reasonable, less a creature of relentless ambition than a man who believed he was doing the right thing for his people. Despite all he'd done and all he intended, I did almost believe him. Almost. I gave a single shake of my head. He slumped back in his chair.
Fine,
he said with a weary shrug.
Make me your villain.
He set his empty glass down and stood.
Come here.
Fear shot through me, but I made myself rise and close the distance between us. He studied me in the firelight. He reached out and touched Morozova's collar, letting his long fingers spread over the rough bone, then slide up my neck to cradle my face with one hand. I felt a jolt of revulsion, but also I felt the sure, intoxicating force of him. I hated that it still had an effect on me.
You betrayed me,
he said softly. I wanted to laugh. I had betrayed him. He had used me, seduced me, and now enslaved me, and I was the betrayer. But I thought of Mal and swallowed my anger and my pride. Yes, I said. I'm sorry for that.
He laughed. You're not sorry for any of it. The only thought you have is for the boy and his miserable life.
I said nothing.
Tell me,
he said, his grip tightening painfully, his fingertips pressing into my flesh. In the firelight, his gaze looked unfathomably bleak.
Tell me how much you love him. Beg for his life.
Please. I whispered, fighting the tears that welled in my eyes. Please spare him.
Why?
Because. The collar can't give you what you want, I said recklessly. I had only one thing with which to bargain, and it was so little, but I pressed on. I have no choice but to serve you, but if Mal comes to harm, I will never forgive you. I will fight you any way that I can. I will spend every waking minute looking for a way to end my life. And eventually I'll succeed.
But show him mercy. Let him live.
And I will serve you gladly.
I will spend the rest of my days proving my gratitude.
I nearly choked out the last word.
He cocked his head to one side. A small, skeptical smile played about his lips.
Then the smile disappeared, replaced by something I didn't recognize, something that looked almost like longing.
Mercy.
He said the word as if he were tasting something unfamiliar.
I could be merciful.
He raised his other hand to cup my face and kissed me softly, gently. And though everything in me rebelled, I let him. I hated him. I feared him. But still I felt the strange tug of his power, and I couldn't stop the hungry response of my own treacherous heart. He pulled away and looked at me. Then his eyes still locked on mine, he called for Ivan.
Take her to the cells,
the Darkling said when Ivan appeared in the doorway of the tent.
Let her see her tracker.
A sliver of hope entered my heart.
Yes, Alina, he said, stroking my cheek. I can be merciful.
He leaned forward, pulling me close, his lips brushing my ear.
Tomorrow we enter the Shadow Fold,
he whispered, his voice like a caress.
And when we do, I will feed your friend to the Volcra, and you will watch him die.
No! I cried, recoiling in horror. I tried to pull away from him, but his grip was like steel, his fingers digging into my skull. You said...
You may say your goodbyes tonight. That is all the mercy traitors deserve.
Something broke loose inside me. I lunged at him, clawing at him, screaming my hate. Ivan was on me in moments, holding me tight as I thrashed and strained in his arms. Murderer! I shouted. Monster!
All of those things.
I hate you, I spat. He shrugged.
You'll tire of hate soon enough. You'll tire of everything.
He smiled then, and behind his eyes I saw the same bleak and yawning chasm I had seen in Bagra's ancient gaze.
You will wear that collar for the rest of your very, very long life, Alina. Fight me as long as you're able. You will find I have far more practice with eternity.
He waved his hand dismissively, and Ivan pulled me from the tent and down the path, still struggling. A sob tore loose from my throat. The tears I had fought to hold back during my conversation with the Darkling gave way and streamed unchecked down my cheeks.
Stop that! Ivan whispered furiously. Someone will see you. I don't care.
The Darkling was going to kill Mal anyway. What difference did it make who saw my misery now? The reality of Mal's death and the Darkling's cruelty were staring me in the face, and I saw the stark and horrible shape of things to come. Ivan yanked me into my tent and gave me a rough shake.
Do you want to see the tracker or not? I'm not going to march a weeping girl through camp.
I pressed my hands against my eyes and stifled my sobs.
Better, he said. Put this on.
He tossed me a long brown cloak. I slipped it over my kefta, and he yanked the large hood up.
Keep your head down and stay quiet, or I swear I'll drag you right back here and you can say your goodbyes on the fold. Understand?
I nodded. We followed an unlit path that skirted the perimeter of the camp. My guards kept their distance, walking far ahead and far behind us, and I quickly realized that Ivan did not want anyone to recognize me or know I was visiting the jail. As we walked between the barracks and the tents, I could sense a strange tension crackling through the camp. The soldiers we passed seemed jumpy, and a few glared at Ivan with blatant hostility. I wondered how the First Army felt about the apparat's sudden rise to power. The jail was located on the far side of the camp. It was an older building, clearly from a time predating the barracks that surrounded it. Bored guards flanked the entrance.
"New prisoner?"
one of them asked Ivan.
"A visitor." "Since when do you escort visitors to the cells?"
"Since tonight," Ivan said, a dangerous edge to his voice. The guards exchanged a nervous glance and stepped aside.
"No need to get antsy, bloodletter."
Ivan led me down a hallway lined with mostly empty cells. I saw a few ragged men, a drunk snoring soundly on the floor of his cell. At the end of the hall, Ivan unlocked a gate, and we descended a set of rickety stairs to a dark, windowless room, lit by a single guttering lamp. In the gloom, I could make out the heavy iron bars of the room's only cell and, sitting slumped by its far wall, its only prisoner.
"Mal,"
I whispered. In seconds, he was on his feet, and we were clinging to each other through the iron bars, our hands clasped tightly together. I couldn't stop the sobs that shook me.
"Shh, it's okay. Alina, it's okay. You have the night," said Ivan, and disappeared back up the stairs.
When we heard the outer gate clang shut, Mal turned to me. His eyes roved over my face.
"I can't believe he let you come."
Fresh tears spilled over my cheeks.
"Mal, he let me come because..."
"When?"
he asked hoarsely. "Tomorrow, on the Shadow Fold." He swallowed, and I could see him struggle with the knowledge, but all he said was,
"All right."
I let out a sound that was half laugh, half sob. "Only you could contemplate imminent death and just say, 'All right.'" He smiled at me and pushed the hair back from my tear-stained face.
"How about, 'Oh, no.'"
"Mal, if I had been stronger..."
"If I had been stronger, I would have driven a knife through your heart."
"I wish you had," I muttered.
"Well, I don't."
I looked down at our clasped hands.
"Mal, what the Darkling said in the glade about him and me, I didn't... I never..."
"It doesn't matter."
I looked up at him. "It doesn't?"
"No,"
he said a little too fiercely. "I don't think I believe you.
So maybe I don't believe it yet either.
Not completely, but it's the truth." He clutched my hands more tightly, holding them close to his heart.
"I don't care if you dance naked on the roof of the little palace with him. I love you, Alina. Even the part of you that loved him."
I wanted to deny it, to erase it, but I couldn't. Another sob shook me. "I hate that I ever thought that I ever..."
"Do you blame me for every mistake I made? For every girl I tumbled? For every dumb thing I've said? Because if we start running tallies on stupid, you know who's going to come out ahead."
"No, I don't blame you."
I managed a small smile. "Much." He grinned, and my heart flip-flopped the way it always had.
"We found our way back to each other, Alina. That's all that matters."
He kissed me through the bars, the cold iron pressing against my cheek as his lips met mine. We stayed together that last night. We talked about the orphanage, the angry rasp of Anakuya's voice, the taste of stolen cherry cordial, the smell of the new-mown grass in our meadow, how we'd suffered in the heat of summer and sought out the cool comfort of the music room's marble floors, the journey we'd made together on our way to do our military service, the Suli violins we'd heard our first night away from the only home either of us could remember. I told him the story of the day I'd been mending pottery with one of the maids in the kitchen at Kerimsen, waiting for him to return from one of the hunting trips that had been taking him from home more and more frequently. I'd been 15, standing at the counter, vainly trying to glue together the jagged pieces of a blue cup. When I saw him crossing the fields, I ran to the doorway and waved. He caught sight of me and broke into a jog. I had crossed the yard to him slowly, watching him draw closer, baffled by the way my heart was skittering around in my chest. Then he'd picked me up and spun me in a circle, and I'd clung to him, breathing in his sweet familiar smell, shocked by how much I'd missed him. Dimly I'd been aware that I still had a shard of the blue cup in my hand, that it was digging into my palm, but I didn't want to let go. When he finally set me down and ambled off to the kitchen to find his lunch, I had stood there, my palm dripping blood, my head still spinning, knowing that everything had changed. Anakuya had scolded me for getting blood on the clean kitchen floor. She'd bandaged my hand and told me it would heal, but I knew it would just go on hurting. In the creaking silence of the cell, Mal kissed the scar on my palm, the wound made so long ago by the edge of that broken cup, a fragile thing I'd thought beyond repair. We fell asleep on the floor, cheeks pressed together through the bars, hands clasped tight. I didn't want to sleep. I wanted to savor every last moment with him. But I must have dozed off because I dreamed again of the stag. This time Mal was beside me in the glade, and it was his blood in the snow. The next thing I knew, I was waking to the sound of the gate being opened above us and Ivan's footsteps on the stairs. Mal had made me promise not to cry. He said it would only make it harder on him. So I swallowed my tears. I kissed him one last time and let Ivan lead me away. Chapter 22. Dawn was creeping over Krybirsk as Ivan brought me back to my tent. I sat down on my cot and stared unseeingly at the room. My limbs felt strange and heavy, my mind a blank. I was still sitting there when Jenya arrived. She helped me wash my face and change into the black kefta I'd worn to the winter fete. I looked down at the silk and thought of tearing it to shreds, but somehow I couldn't manage to move. My hands stayed limp at my sides. Jenya steered me into the painted chair. I sat still as she arranged my hair, pulling it onto my head in loops and coils that she secured with golden pins, the better to show off Morozova's collar. When she had finished, she pressed her cheek against mine and led me to Ivan, placing my hand on his arm like a bride. Not a word had passed between us. Ivan led me to the Grisha tent, where I took my place by the darkling's side. I knew that my friends were watching me, whispering, wondering what was wrong. They probably thought I was nervous about entering the fold. They were wrong. I wasn't nervous or frightened. I wasn't anything anymore. The Grisha followed us in an ordered processional all the way to the dry docks. There, only a select few were permitted to board the sand skiff. It was larger than any I'd seen and equipped with three enormous sails emblazoned with a darkling symbol. I scanned the crowd of soldiers and Grisha on the skiff. I knew Mal must be on board somewhere, but I couldn't see him. The darkling and I were escorted to the front of the skiff, where I was introduced to a group of elaborately dressed men with blonde beards and piercing blue eyes. With a start, I realized they were Fjärden ambassadors. Beside them, in crimson silks, stood a delegation from the Shuhan, and next to them a group of Kirch tradesmen, in short coats with curiously belled sleeves. An envoy of the king stood with them in full military dress, his pale blue sash bearing a golden double eagle, a stern expression on his weathered countenance. I studied them curiously. This must be why the Darkling had delayed our trip into the fold. He needed time to assemble the proper audience, witnesses who would attest to his newfound power. But just how far did he intend to go? A feeling of foreboding stirred inside me, disturbing the lovely numbness that had held me in its grip all morning. The skiff shuddered and began to slide over the grass and into the eerie black mist of the fold. Three summoners raised their arms, and the great sails snapped forward, swelling with wind. The first time I'd entered the fold, I'd feared the darkness and my own death. Now darkness was nothing to me, and I knew that soon death would seem like a gift. I'd always known I would have to return to the unsee, But as I looked back, I realized that some part of me had anticipated it. I had welcomed the change to prove myself, and I cringed when I thought of it, to please the darkling. I had dreamed of this moment, standing by his side. I had wanted to believe in the destiny he'd laid out for me, that the orphan no one wanted would change the world and be adored for it. The darkling stared ahead, radiating confidence and ease. The sun flickered and began to disappear from view. A moment later, we were in darkness. For a long while, we drifted in the black, the Grisha squallers driving the skiffs forward over the sand. Then the darkling's voice rang out.
Burn!
Huge clouds of flame burst from the Inferni on either side of the skift, briefly illuminating the night sky. The ambassadors and even the guards around me stirred nervously. The darkling was announcing our location, calling the Volcra directly to us. It didn't take long for them to answer, and a tremor ran up my spine as I heard the distant beat of leathery wings. I felt fear spread through the passengers on the skiff, and heard the Fjerdans begin to pray in their lilting tongue. In the flare of Grisha fire, I saw the dim shapes of dark bodies flying toward us. The Volcra's shriek split the air. The guards reached for their rifles. Someone began to weep, but still the darkling waited as the Volcra drew closer. Bagra had claimed that the Volcra had once been men and women, victims of the unnatural power unleashed by the darkling's greed. It might have been my mind playing tricks, but I thought I heard something not just horrible, but human in their cries. When they were almost upon us, the darkling gripped my arm and simply said, "Now." That invisible hand took hold of the power inside me, and I felt it stretch, reaching through the darkness of the fold, seeking the light. It came to me with a speed and fury that nearly knocked me from my feet, breaking over me in a shower of brilliance and warmth. The fold was alight, brilliant as noon, as if its impenetrable darkness had never been. I saw a long reach of blanched sand, hulks of what looked like shipwrecks dotting the dead landscape, and above it all, a teeming flock of Volcra. They screamed in terror, their writhing gray bodies gruesome in the bright sunlight. "This is the truth of him," I thought as I squinted into the dazzling light. "Like calls to like." This was his soul made flesh, the truth of him laid bare in the blazing sun, shorn of mystery and shadow. This was the truth behind the handsome face and the miraculous powers, the truth that was the dead and empty space between the stars, a wasteland peopled by frightened monsters. "Make a path." I wasn't sure if he spoke or simply thought the command that reverberated through me. Helpless, I let the fold close in around us as I focused the light, making a channel through which the skiff could pass, bordered on both sides by walls of rippling darkness. The Volcra fled into the dark, and I could hear them crying in rage and confusion as if from behind an impenetrable curtain. We sped over the colorless sands, the sunlight spreading in glimmering waves before us. Far ahead I saw a flash of green, and I realized I was seeing the other side of the shadow fold. We were looking into West Ravka, and as we drew closer, I saw their meadow, their dry docks. The village of Novokrybirsk nestled behind it. The towers of Oskervo gleamed in the distance. Was it my imagination, or could I smell the salt tang of the true sea on the air? People were streaming from the village and crowding onto the dry docks, pointing at the light that had split the fold open before them. I saw children playing in the grass. I could hear the dock workers calling to each other. At a signal from the darkling, the skiff slowed, and he lifted his arms. I felt a spike of horror as I understood what was about to happen. "They're your own people," I cried desperately. He ignored me and brought his hands together with a sound like a clap of thunder. It all seemed to happen slowly. Darkness rippled out from his hands. When it met the darkness of the fold, a rumbling sound rose up out of the dead sands, The black walls of the path I'd created pulsed and swelled.
It's like it's breathing, I thought in terror.
The rumble grew to a roar. The fold shook and trembled around us and then burst forward into a terrible, cascading tide. A frightened wail went up from the crowd on the docks as darkness rushed toward them. They ran, and I saw their fear, heard their screams as the black fabric of the fold crashed over the dry docks and the village, like a breaking wave. Darkness enveloped them, and the Volcra set upon their new prey. A woman carrying a little boy stumbled, trying to outrun the grasping dark, but it swallowed her too. I reached inside of myself, desperately, trying to expand the light, to drive the Volcra off, to offer some kind of protection, but I could do nothing. My power slid away from me, pulled from me by that invisible, taunting hand. I wished for a knife to drive into the Darkling's heart, into my own heart, anything that would make this stop. The Darkling turned to look at the ambassadors and the King's envoy. Their faces were identical masks of horror and shock. Whatever he saw there must have satisfied him because he separated his hands, and the darkness stopped pushing forward. The rumbling faded. I could hear the anguished cries of those lost in the dark, the shrieks of the Volcra, the sounds of rifle fire. The dry docks were gone. The village of Novokhribirsk was gone. We were staring into the new reaches of the fold. The message was clear. Today it had been Westravka. Tomorrow the Darkling could just as easily push the fold north to Fjärda, or south to the Shuhan. It would devour whole countries and drive the Darkling's enemies into the sea. How many deaths had I just helped to bring about? How many more would I be responsible for? Close the path, commanded the Darkling. I had no choice but to obey. I pulled the light back until it rested around the skiff like a glowing dome.
What have you done?
Whispered the envoy, his voice shaking. The Darkling turned on him.
Do you need to see more?
You were meant to undo this abomination, not enlarge it. You've slaughtered Ravkans, the king. We'll never stand.
The king will do as he's told, or I'll march the Shadow Fold to the walls of Os-Alta itself.
The envoy sputtered, his mouth opening and closing soundlessly. The Darkling turned to the ambassadors.
I think you understand me now. There are no Ravkans, no Fjärdins, no Kerch, no Shuhan. There are no more borders, and there will be no more wars. From now on, there is only the land inside the fold and outside of it, and there will be peace.
Peace on your terms, said one of the Shuhan angrily.
It will not stand,
blustered a Fjärdin. The Darkling looked them over and said very calmly,
Peace on my terms. Or your precious mountains and your saints' forsaken tundra will simply cease to exist.
With crushing certainty, I understood that he meant every word. The ambassadors might hope it was an empty threat, believe that there were limits to his hunger, but they would learn, soon enough. The Darkling would not hesitate. He would not grieve. His darkness would consume the world. And he would never waver. The Darkling turned his back on their stunned and angry expressions and addressed the Grisha and soldiers on the skiff.
Tell the story of what you've seen today. Tell everyone that the days of fear and uncertainty are over. The days of endless fighting are over. Tell them that you saw a new age begin.
A cheer went up from the crowd. I saw a few soldiers muttering to each other. Even some of the Grisha looked unnerved. But most of their faces were eager, triumphant, shining. They're hungry for this, I realized, even after they've seen what he can do, even after watching their own people die. The Darkling wasn't just offering them an end to war, but an end to weakness. After all these long years of terror and suffering, he would give them something that had seemed permanently beyond their grasp. Victory. And despite their fear, they loved him for it. The Darkling signaled to Ivan, who stood behind him, waiting for orders.
"Bring me the prisoner."
I looked up sharply, a fresh bolt of fear shooting through me as Mal was led through the crowd to the railing, his hands bound.
"We return to Ravka," said the Darkling. "But the traitor stays."
Before I even knew what was happening, Ivan shoved Mal over the edge of the skiff. The Volcra screeched and beat their wings. I ran to the railing. Mal was on his side in the sand, still within the protective circle of my light. He spat sand from his mouth and pushed himself up with his bound hands. "Mal!" I cried. Without thinking, I turned on Ivan and punched him hard in the jaw. He stumbled back against the railing, stunned, and then lunged at me. "Good," I thought as he grabbed me. "Throw me over, too."
"Hold," said the Darkling, his voice like ice.
Ivan scowled, his face red with embarrassment and anger. He relaxed his grip, but didn't let go. I could see the confusion of the people on the skiff. They didn't know what this show was about, why the Darkling was troubling with a deserter, or why his most valued Grisha had just punched his second-in-command.
"Pull it back."
The command rang through me, and I looked at the Darkling in horror.
"No,"
I said. But I couldn't stop it. The dome of light began to contract. Mal looked at me as the circle shrank closer to the skiff. And if Ivan hadn't had hold of me, the look of regret and love in his blue eyes would have sent me to my knees. I fought with everything inside me, every bit of strength I had, everything Bagra had taught me, and it was nothing in the face of the Darkling's power over me. The light inched closer to the skiff. I gripped the railing and cried out in rage, in misery, the tears streaming down my cheeks. Mal was standing at the edge of the gleaming circle now. I could see the shapes of the Volcra in the swirling dark, feel the beat of their wings. He could have run, could have wept, could have clung to the sides of the skiff until the darkness took him. But he did none of those things. He stood unflinching before the gathering dark. Only I had the power to save him, and I was powerless to save him. In the next breath, the darkness swallowed him. I heard him scream. The memory of the stag reared up before me so vivid that for a moment the snowy glade swam in my vision, the image of it transposed over the barren landscape of the fold. I smelled the pines, felt the chill air on my cheeks. I remembered the stag's dark, liquid eyes, the plume of his breath in the cold night, the moment when I knew that I would not take his life. And finally, I understood why the stag had come to me every night in my dreams. I'd thought the stag was haunting me, a reminder of my failure and the price my weakness would exact. But I was wrong. The stag had been showing me my strength. Not just the price of mercy, but the power it bestowed. And mercy was something the Darkling would never understand. I had spared the stag's life. The power of that life belonged to me as surely as it belonged to the man who had taken it. I gasped as understanding flooded through me, and I felt that invisible grip falter. My power slid back into my hands. Once more I stood in Bagra's hut, calling the light for the first time, feeling it rush toward me, taking possession of what was rightfully mine. This was what I had been born for. I would never let anyone separate me from it again. Light exploded from me, pure and unwavering, flooding over the dark place where Mal had stood only moments before. The Volcra that had hold of him shrieked and released its grip. Mal fell to his knees, blood streaming from his wounds as my light enveloped him, and drove the Volcra back into the darkness. The Darkling looked momentarily confused. He narrowed his eyes, and I felt his will descend on me, felt that invisible hand grasping. I shrugged it off. It was nothing. He was nothing.
What is this? He hissed. He raised his hands, and skeins of darkness spooled toward me, but with a flick of my hand they burned away like mist. The darkling advanced on me, his handsome features contorted with fury. My mind was working frantically. I knew he would have liked to kill me where I stood, but he couldn't. Not with the Vulcra circling outside the light that only I could provide.
"Seize her!"
he shouted to the guards surrounding us. Ivan reached out. I felt the weight of the collar around my neck, the steady rhythm of the stag's ancient heart beating in time with mine. My power rose up in me, solid and without hesitation, a sword in my hand. I lifted my arm and slashed. With an ear-splitting crack, one of the skiff's masts split in two. People bleated in panic and scattered as the broken mast fell to the deck, the thick wood gleaming with burning light. Shock registered on the darkling's face.
"The cut!"
Ivan gasped, taking a step backward. "Stay back," I warned.
"You aren't a murderer, Alina," said the darkling.
"I think the Ravkins I just helped you slaughter would disagree." Panic was spreading through the skiff. The Oprichniki looked wary, but they were fanning out to surround me just the same.
"You saw what he did to those people,"
I cried to the guards and the Grisha around me.
"Is that the future you want? A world of darkness? A world remade in his image?"
I saw their confusion, their anger and fear.
"It's not too late to stop him. Help me," I begged. "Please, help me."
But no one moved. Soldier and Grisha alike stood frozen on the deck. They were all too afraid. Afraid of him and afraid of a world without his protection. The Oprichniki inched closer. I had to make a choice. Mal and I wouldn't have another chance.
"So be it," I thought.
I glanced over my shoulder, hoping Mal understood, and then I dove for the side of the skiff.
"Don't let her reach the railing,"
the darkling shouted.
The guards surged toward me, and I let the light go out.
We were plunged into darkness. People wailed, and above us I heard the Vulcra screeching. My outstretched hands struck the railing. I ducked under it and hurled myself onto the sand, rolling to my feet and running blindly toward Mal as I threw the light ahead of me in an arc. Behind me I heard the sounds of slaughter on the skiff as the Vulcra attacked, and clouds of Grisha flame exploded in the darkness. But I couldn't stop to think of the people I'd left behind. My arc of light flashed over Mal, crouched in the sand. The Vulcra looming over him screeched and whirled away into the dark. I sprinted toward him and pulled him to his feet. A bullet pinged against the sand beside us, and I plunged us into darkness again.
"Hold your fire!"
I heard the darkling shouting over the chaos of the skiff.
"We need her alive."
I threw out another arc of light, scattering the Vulcra that were hovering around us.
"You can't run from me, Alina,"
the darkling shouted. I couldn't let him come after us. I couldn't take the chance that he might survive. But I hated what I had to do. The others on the skiff had failed to come to my aid. But did they deserve to be abandoned to the Vulcra?
"You can't leave us all here to die, Alina,"
the darkling shouted.
"If you take this step, you know where it will lead."
I felt a hysterical laugh burble up inside me. I knew. I knew it would make me more like him.
"You begged me for clemency once,"
he called over the dead reaches of the fold, over the hungry shrieks of the horrors he had made.
"Is this your idea of mercy?"
Another bullet hit the sand only inches from us. "Yes," I thought as the power rose up inside me. "The mercy you taught me." I raised my hand and brought it down in a blazing arc, slashing through the air. An earth-shaking crack echoed through the fold as the sand skiff split in half. Raw screams filled the air and the Vulcra shrieked in their frenzy. I grabbed Mal's arm and threw a dome of light around us. We ran, stumbling into the darkness.
and soon the sounds of battle faded as we left the monsters behind. We emerged from the fold somewhere south of Novokrybirsk and took our first steps in West Ravka. The afternoon sun was bright, the meadow grass green and sweet, but we didn't stop to savor any of it. We were tired, hungry, and wounded. But our enemies wouldn't rest, and neither would we. We walked until we found cover in an orchard, and hid there until dark, afraid of being spotted and remembered. The air was thick with the smell of apple blossoms, but the fruit was far too small and green to eat. There was a bucket full of fetid rainwater sitting beneath our tree, and we used it to wash the worst stains from Mal's bloodied shirt. He tried not to wince as he pulled the torn fabric over his head, but there was no disguising the deep wounds the vulcrous claws had left across the smooth skin of his shoulders and back. When night came, we began our trek to the coast. Briefly, I worried that we might be lost, but even in a strange country, Mal found the way. Shortly before dawn, we crested a hill and saw the broad sweep of Alcum Bay and the glittering lights of Oskirvo below us. We knew we should get off the road. It would soon be bustling with tradesmen and travelers, who were sure to notice a cut-up tracker and a girl in a black kefta. But we couldn't resist our first glimpse of the true sea. The sun rose at our backs, pink light gleaming off the city's slender towers, then splintering gold on the waters of the bay. I saw the sprawl of the port, the great ships bobbing in the harbor, and beyond that, blue and blue and blue again. The sea seemed to go on forever, stretching into an impossibly distant horizon. I had seen plenty of maps. I knew there was land out there somewhere, beyond long weeks of travel and miles of ocean. But I still had the dizzying sense that we were standing at the edge of the world. A breeze came in off the water, carrying the smell of salt and damp, the faint cries of gulls. "There's just so much of it," I said at last. Mal nodded. Then he turned to me and smiled. "A good place to hide." He reached out and slid his hand into my hair. He pulled one of the gold pins from the tangled waves. I felt a curl slide free and slither down my neck. "For clothes," he said as he dropped the pin into his pocket. A day ago, Jenya had placed those golden pins in my hair. I would never see her again. Never see any of them. My heart twisted. I didn't know if Jenya had ever really been my friend, but I would miss her just the same. Mal left me waiting a little way off the road, hidden in a stand of trees. We'd agreed it would be safer for him to enter Oskarvo by himself, but it was hard to watch him go. He told me to rest, but once he was gone, I couldn't seem to find sleep. I could still feel power thrumming through my body, the echo of what I'd done on the fold. My hand strayed to the collar at my neck. I'd never felt anything like it, and some part of me wanted to feel it again. "And what about the people you left there?" said a voice in my head that I desperately wanted to ignore. "Ambassadors, soldiers, Grisha." I had as good as doomed them all, and I couldn't even be sure that the Darkling was dead. Had he been torn apart by Volkra? Had the lost men and women of the Tula Valley finally had their revenge on the black heretic? Or was he, at this very moment, hurtling toward me over the dead reaches of the Unsea, ready to bring down his own kind of reckoning? I shuddered and paced, flinching at every sound. By late afternoon, I was convinced that Mal had been identified and captured. When I heard footsteps and saw his familiar form emerge through the trees, I nearly sobbed with relief. "Any trouble?" I asked shakily, trying to hide my nerves. "None," he said. "I've never seen a city so crowded with people. No one even gave me a second glance." He wore a new shirt and an ill-fitting coat, and his arms were laden with clothes for me, a sack-like dress in a red so faded it looked almost orange, and a nubbly, mustard-colored coat. He handed them to me and then tactfully turned his back so that I could change. I fumbled with the tiny black buttons of the kefta. There seemed to be 1,000 of them. When the silk finally slid over my shoulders and pooled at my feet, I felt a great burden lift from me. The cool spring air pricked my bare skin, and for the first time,
I dared to hope that we might really be free. I quashed that thought. Until I knew the Darkling was dead, I would never draw an easy breath. I put on the rough wool dress and the yellow coat. "Did you deliberately buy the ugliest clothes you could find?" Mal turned to look at me and couldn't resist a smile.
"I bought the first clothes I could find," he said.
Then his grin faded. He touched my cheek lightly, and when he spoke again, his voice was low and raw.
"I never want to see you in black again."
I held his gaze. "Never," I whispered. He reached into his coat pocket and pulled out a long red scarf. Gently he wrapped it around my neck, hiding Morozova's collar.
"There," he said, smiling again. "Perfect."
"What am I going to do when summer comes?" I laughed.
"By then we'll have found a way to get rid of it."
"No," I said sharply, surprised by how much the idea upset me. Mal recoiled, taken aback.
"We can't get rid of it," I explained. "It's Ravka's only chance to be free of the Shadowfold."
It was the truth, just not all of it. We did need the collar. It was insurance against the Darkling's strength and a promise that someday we'd return to Ravka and find a way to set things right. But what I couldn't tell Mal was that the collar belonged to me, that the stag's power felt like a part of me now, and I wasn't sure I wanted to let it go. Mal studied me, his brow furrowed. I thought of the Darkling's warnings, of the bleak look I'd seen in his face and in Bagra's.
"Alina."
I tried for a reassuring smile. "We'll get rid of it," I promised.
"As soon as we can."
Seconds passed. "All right," he said at last, but his expression was still wary. Then he pushed the crumpled kefta with the toe of his boot.
"What should we do with this?"
I looked down at the heap of tattered silk and felt anger and shame roll over me.
"Burn it," I said.
And we did.
As the flames consumed the silk,
Mal slowly pulled the rest of the golden pins from my curls, one by one, until my hair tumbled around my shoulders. Gently he pushed my hair aside and kissed my neck, right above the collar. When the tears came, he pulled me close and held me, until there was nothing left but ashes. After. The boy and the girl stand at the railing of the ship, a true ship that rolls and rocks on the heaving back of the true sea.
"Good morning, Vendemin,"
a deckhand shouts to them as he passes by, his arms full of rope. All the ship's crew call them Fentimen. It is the Kerch word for ghosts. When the girl asks the quartermaster why, he laughs and says it's because they are so pale, and because of the way they stand silent at the ship's railing, staring at the sea for hours, as if they've never seen water before. She smiles and does not tell him the truth, that they must keep their eyes on the horizon. They are watching for a ship with black sails. Bagra's Verloren was long gone, so they had hidden in the slums of Oskervo until the boy could use the gold pins from her hair to book passage on another ship. The city buzzed with the horror of what had happened in Novokrybirsk. Some blamed the Darkling. Others blamed the Shuhan or Fjerdens. A few even claimed it was the righteous work of angry saints. Rumors began to reach them of strange happenings in Ravka. They heard that the apparat had disappeared, that foreign troops were massing on the borders, that the First and Second Armies were threatening to go to war with each other, that the Sun Summoner was dead. They waited to hear word of the Darkling's death on the fold, but it never came. At night, the boy and the girl lie curled around each other in the belly of the ship. He holds her tight when she wakes from another nightmare, her teeth chattering, her ears ringing with the terrified screams of the men and women she left behind on the broken skiff, her limbs trembling with remembered power.
"It's all right," he whispers in the darkness. "It's all right."
She wants to believe him, but she's afraid to close her eyes. The wind creaks in the sails. The ship sighs around them.
They are alone again, as they were when they were young, hiding from the older children, from Anakuya's temper, from the things that seem to move and slither in the dark. They are orphans again, with no true home but each other, and whatever life they can make together on the other side of the sea.
This book is over, but the story continues. Keep listening after the credits to hear the beginning of Siege and Storm, Book 2 in the Grisha series free.
This has been an Audible Inc. production of Shadow and Bone, written by Lee Bardugo, narrated by Lauren Fortgang. Producer, Mike Charzik. Copyright 2012 by Lee Bardugo. Production copyright 2012 by Audible, Inc.
And now a free preview of Siege and Storm, Book 2 in the Grisha series.
Before. The boy and the girl had once dreamed of ships long ago, before they'd ever seen the true sea. They were the vessels of stories, magic ships with masts hewn from sweet cedar and sails spun by maidens from thread of pure gold. Their crews were white mice who sang songs and scrubbed the decks with their pink tails. The Verheder was not a magic ship. It was a Kirch trader, its hold bursting with millet and molasses. It stank of unwashed bodies and the raw onions the sailors claimed would prevent scurvy. Its crew spat and swore and gambled for rum rations. The bread the boy and the girl were given spilled weevils, and their cabin was a cramped closet they were forced to share with two other passengers and a barrel of salt cod. They didn't mind. They grew used to the clang of bells sounding the hour, the cry of the gulls, the unintelligible gabble of Kirch. The ship was their kingdom, and the sea a vast moat that kept their enemies at bay. The boy took to life aboard the ship as easily as he took to everything else. He learned to tie knots and mend sails, and as his wounds healed, he worked the lines beside the crew. He abandoned his shoes and climbed barefoot and fearless in the rigging. The sailors marveled at the way he spotted dolphins, schools of rays, bright striped tigerfish, the way he sensed the place a whale would breach the moment before its broad, pebbled back broke the waves. They claimed they'd be rich if they just had a bit of his luck. The girl made them nervous. 3 days out to sea, the captain asked her to remain below decks as much as possible. He blamed it on the crew's superstition, claimed that they thought women aboard ship would bring ill winds. This was true, but the sailors might have welcomed a laughing, happy girl, a girl who told jokes or tried her hand at the tin whistle. This girl stood quiet and unmoving by the rail, clutching her scarf around her neck, frozen like a figurehead carved from white wood. This girl screamed in her sleep and woke the men dozing in the foretop. So the girl spent her days haunting the dark belly of the ship. She counted barrels of molasses, studied the captain's charts. At night, she slipped into the shelter of the boy's arms as they stood together on deck, picking out constellations from the vast spill of stars. The hunter, the scholar, the three foolish sons, the bright spokes of the spinning wheel, the southern palace, with its six crooked spires. She kept him there as long as she could, telling stories, asking questions, because she knew when she slept, she would dream. Sometimes she dreamed of broken skiffs with black sails and decks slick with blood, of people crying out in the darkness. But worse were the dreams of a pale prince, who pressed his lips to her neck, who placed his hands on the collar that circled her throat and called forth her power in a blaze of bright sunlight. When she dreamed of him, she woke shaking, the echo of her power still vibrating through her, the feeling of the light still warm on her skin. The boy held her tighter, murmured soft words to lull her to sleep.
"It's only a nightmare," he whispered. "The dreams will stop."
He didn't understand. The dreams were the only place it was safe to use her power now, and she longed for them. On the day the Verhader made land, the boy and the girl stood at the rail together, watching as the coast of Novia Zem drew closer. They drifted into harbor through an orchard of weathered masts and bound sails. There were sleek sloops and little junks from the rocky coasts of the Shuhan, armed warships and pleasure schooners, fat merchantmen and Fjerdan whalers. A bloated prison galley bound for the southern colonies flew the red-tipped banner that warned there were murderers aboard. As they floated by, the girl could have sworn she heard the clink of chains. The Verhader found its berth. The gangway was lowered. The dock workers and crew shouted their greetings, tied off ropes, prepared the cargo. The boy and the girl scanned the docks, searching the crowd for a flash of Heartrender crimson or Summoner blue, for the glint of sunlight off Ravkin guns. It was time. The boy slid his hand into hers. His palm was rough and calloused from the days he'd spent working the lines. When their feet hit the planks of the quay, the ground seemed to buck and roll beneath them. The sailors laughed.
"Varwell, Phantomen," they cried.
The boy and the girl walked forward and took their first rolling steps in the new world. "Please," the girl prayed silently to any saints who might be listening, "let us be safe here. Let us be home." Chapter 1 2 weeks we'd been in Coughton, and I was still getting lost. The town lay inland, west of the Novia Zem coast, miles from the harbor where we'd landed. Soon we would go farther, deep into the wilds of the Zemini frontier. Maybe then we'd begin to feel safe. I checked the little map I'd drawn for myself and retraced my steps. Mal and I met every day after work to walk back to the boarding house together, but today I'd gotten completely turned around when I detoured to buy our dinner. The calf and collard pies were stuffed into my satchel and giving off a very peculiar smell. The shopkeeper had claimed they were a Zemini delicacy, but I had my doubts. It didn't much matter. Everything tasted like ashes to me lately. Mal and I had come to Coughton to find work that would finance our trip west. It was the center of the Jurda trade, surrounded by fields of the little orange flowers that people chewed by the bushel. The stimulant was considered a luxury in Ravka, but some of the sailors aboard the Verhader had used it to stay awake on long watches. Zemini men liked to tuck the dried blooms between lip and gum, and even the women carried them in embroidered pouches that dangled from their wrists. Each store window I passed advertised different brands: Brightleaf, Shade, Daka, the Burley. I saw a beautifully dressed girl in petticoats lean over and spit a stream of rust-colored juice right into one of the brass spittoons that sat outside every shop door. I stifled a gag. That was one Zemini custom I didn't think I could get used to. With a sigh of relief, I turned onto the city's main thoroughfare. At least now I knew where I was. Coughton still didn't feel quite real to me. There was something raw and unfinished about it. Most of the streets were unpaved, and I always felt like the flat-roofed buildings with their flimsy wooden walls might tip over at any minute. And yet they all had glass windows, the women dressed in velvet and lace. The shop displays overflowed with sweets and baubles and all manner of finery, instead of rifles, knives, and tin cookpots. Here even the beggars wore shoes. This was what a country looked like when it wasn't under siege. As I passed a gin shop,
I caught a flash of crimson out of the corner of my eye.
Corporal Kai.
Instantly I drew back, pressing myself into the shadowy space between two buildings, heart hammering, my hand already